Anya Highmarch is a mother of five, stepmother, entrepreneur, and globally renowned businesswoman. Having set up her business when she was just 18, she shares the lessons learned along the way, successes and failures, and why washing your hair is almost always the answer.
And so there's a whole system to it, which is just actually being taught in the right way. So I think we shouldn't use the words control freak. I think we should call ourselves organisational legends. That's how we're going to reframe it. I call him my harshest critic, because if I ask advice from him, it will always be quite tough but absolutely unvarnished advice, which is actually the most useful advice, honestly. I have to say, don't I? Wash your hair.
Anya, first up, I want to say thank you for coming on this pod. I feel like you're doing me a massive favour, and that this might well be your worst nightmare, because you're such a private person usually. So I just want to say thank you in advance. Is this sort of thing your worst nightmare?
Chatting to you on a Friday afternoon? No, not at all. It's a great pleasure and an honour. I am quite a private person, but I think when I wrote the book, I sort of gave that up, didn't I? That's the awful thing. You sort of cross the Rubicon. So I think, it's lovely to see you. Nice to chat.
You're currently operating, many would say, at the top of your game. Is it sort of where you want to be? Are you where you want to be in your life right now?
In operating top of my game, I read that as operating at sort of full pelt. So yes, sometimes I would say it's a little unsustainable, actually, my pace at the moment. In terms of, do I feel, have I reached my sort of, you know, the pinnacle? No, I absolutely don't feel that. I worry that if I felt that would all go really wrong at that point anyway. But no, I think that the more you do, the more you actually just feel complete insecurity about what you haven't done. And there's always the next mountain to climb. And I think that's probably quite a good thing. It'd be really boring if you felt you'd done it, right? So no, I feel mostly like I've got a very long to-do list.
What's at the top of it?
That moment when you kind of breathe out. Doing a lot of exhaling. It's funny, isn't it? When you go on holiday, the first thing you do, you sit on a sunbed and you sit on the beach and you go, oh, you know, it's the same when you kind of, you know, if you lie on a massage table or you sit sometimes on a plane and you kind of made it that far and you sort of do the big exhale. I think exhaling is quite important, actually. And so I guess when you get to that point where, the children are happy and maybe they've all got a roof over their heads and that's all kind of good and, you know, you've sort of, everything's sort of ticked and tied. But I don't know. I mean, I think I'm quite sure, knowing myself as well as I do now, that there'll be the next mountain, and that's fun. And actually, you realise that you pick your challenges. I once went to see an acupuncturist who, I was exhausted and I sort of said, I've got this and this and this and this, when he asked. And then he went, yeah, but you chose all of that, didn't you? And it was actually a pretty good lesson.
Sympathetic.
I do choose it. It annoyed me at first, but it actually made me realize that these are all choices. You know, in COVID, we didn't do anything, and that was bliss in many ways. But it was, you know, I've gone back to full pelt because I'm curious and I'm excited and I like to do things, and I'm a sucker and I'm a people pleaser and all those things that we all are. And maybe I'm ambitious. And so actually, they're all choices. So yes, there's lots to do. Lots of mountains to climb.
And when there's lots to do and there's lots of mountains to climb, presumably you have to be uber organized about it. And if I think about your brand, and the things I personally love about your brand is that it absolutely deals with organization and puts that front and center. I mean, is that because that's who you are and what you need in your world?
Yeah, it's completely come out of need. I mean, it started actually, so we have a whole shop dedicated to organisation, which we call the Label Shop. And it comes out of the fact that when I was much younger and doing a lot of travelling, and when there were all different currencies and we didn't use, when we used currency, I used to have these little, started off by being little bags, which I would have my dollars in and my yen in and my, you know, Hong Kong dollars in and so on. And then I'd have separate bags for the receipts from the Hong Kong trip and the Japan trip and the American trip. And it was all organised. And then I thought, actually, I can do this in a nicer way. And I started making little leather pouches, which one that said dollars and then the other says dollars receipts. And I just love all that organisation, because it makes you efficient, because it saves time. I can then hand that receipts bag to my assistant and kind of say, could you do the expenses? So it's just... when I could finally afford an assistant in those days. But it's just, it's a nice way, I think, that when you feel out of control, it makes you feel a bit more in control. So it's sort of, you know, it's a bit nerdy, but it works. And so organisation has been pivotal, frankly, to me being able to do and juggle all the things that, you know, us women juggle.
How important is control to you? I was thinking about this regarding myself the other day and wondering if I'm a control freak or not. And I couldn't decide which way I sort of sat on that debate. Do you consider yourself a control freak or not really?
Yes, but I see it as a good thing. I've had to kind of relook at that because control freak sounds like, you know, you're a nightmare, which I probably am, and, you know, a bit bossy, and I probably am, in all fairness, and a bit controlling, I definitely am. But at the same time, those are kind of organisational skills, which are in turn leadership skills, and which in turn allow you to organise and run businesses, you know, all over the world, and juggle all the zillions of tasks that come in thrown at you into your inbox, your Instagram. People send you messages on Instagram inviting you to things. It's just like, God, so many inboxes and incoming streams to manage. You've got to juggle all of that, plus all the kids, plus all the school dates, plus all the stuff we deal with, and somehow get it into a list and organize it by priority and get it done, right? I mean, we do an awful lot. And I think women actually have the lion's share, mostly, not always, but mostly at home. And so we should not actually do ourselves down. I think control freak sounds a bit derogatory. And actually, I think we're legends, frankly, us women, for managing all of that stuff and actually making it happen and not having a complete nervous breakdown too often. So organisation is a great thing. And actually, I slightly wish that we had all been taught more at school on best practice forms of organisation. My son, actually, my elder son is a lawyer. And in his first week at Freshfields, where he was working, they actually gave him a training on best practice management of your inbox. And I was so fascinated by it that I actually contacted the people who organised it. And we actually ran workshops in our label stores. And it was absolutely inundated because actually, you know, you're meant to always have a zero inbox, you know, a completely empty inbox. And they teach you how to do it and how to manage it, because a lot of people, and me included, you know, you can stall on things. And so there's a whole system to it, which is just actually being taught in the right way. So I think we shouldn't use the words control freak. I think we should call ourselves organisational legends. That's how we're going to reframe it.
I love that. Anya, I've just glanced across at my inbox. Do you want to know how many I've got of messages flashing up in that red box? 14,694.
I'm going to send you these people immediately. That actually slightly brings me out in hives. So I am a nerd. Every Sunday I get to, my kids laugh, I always say I've got to get to the bottom of my inbox. And in fact, they actually made me something that talked about the bottom of her inbox. So I just have to, it's like washing my hair, I have to do that every week to kind of deal with it, file it, move it on. So the idea of having, my husband's like that, I can't, it actually makes me feel, you know, quite like I've got a rash.
I feel like I actually have to cancel. Well, no, I feel like I have to cancel that email account. I actually think that the only way to handle that now, moving forward, would be to start again. And I might have to actually do that, because it is, as you say, it's like a tidy mind, a tidy life, all of those sort of sayings that fit into that way of thinking. I feel like I am losing control because of that inbox, and I need to address it. Yeah,
people who have sent you requests or loving messages or thank yous, or
yes,
you're just going to bin all those messages. I mean, that feels a little bit mean. I know that policy.
That's why do you think it's got 14,000 in there? It's because I can't bring myself to delete the inbox yet.
My father my father once said that there was a point where he felt so overwhelmed by his inbox, he put the whole thing in the bin when it was a physical inbox, because he said anything important will come back to me. It's always sort of sat with me, that thought, which is true. I'm there waiting for the message to come in. I bat it back immediately. I'm like, so, I mean, it's stupid, because of course the more you do and the more you behave like that, the more incoming you get. Sometimes you're better if you don't answer. Unfortunately, if you don't answer things, people don't often ask twice, but I'm too polite. I'm annoyingly polite.
Yes, quite right. And that's the right way to be. I want to ask you about what it takes to become and be an entrepreneur. Is it instinctive or can it be taught? Because it's one of those things that many people have an idea and want to then see it into sort of a reality, but it doesn't always happen like that. So how does a light bulb moment become a reality? What are the skills needed by the person behind that idea to make things happen?
I think it, you know, nature or nurture. I don't know. I think it's a bit of both, honestly. I mean, mine is nature and nurture. I know people who are nature and nailed it, and people who are nurture only and nailed it. So I don't think it's, I mean, it helps to be surrounded by entrepreneurs and to come, I think, or to put yourself into that kind of, I think who you surround yourself by can make a huge difference. I think the one word, if I was to pick one word that sums up the key ingredient for being an entrepreneur, I think it's about being positive. I'm a huge believer in being positive. Positive management, positive, clear communication, you know, being nice. I really believe in that sort of positivity drives success. And actually, whenever I've sat on, you know, other organizations or got involved and seen the sort of people I really admire operate, they actually are hugely positive. They're like, thank you, that was the best cup of tea. And actually, that's well done for smashing your numbers. Don't worry, it didn't quite work out, but you know what, we're going to do it next week. That positivity, I think, breeds positive energy. And I know that you can do the Alan Sugar way, which is, you know, it's more stick than carrot, but I'm all about the carrot. And I think people like to work in that environment. It's not to say that you can't be tough in many ways, or, you know, but you can be fair. But I think positivity is absolutely imperative. And I think that entrepreneurs, honestly, are insanely positive. You know, they assume and believe in their project, despite years and years of not making money and putting their house on the line and risking everything and working all day and all night. You know, they're absolutely relentlessly positive. And so I think that's the one thing you need. I think that if you're too kind of cautious and you're a negative person, that's often doesn't often thrive in that entrepreneurial sort of world. Because you've got to have an idea and you've got to say, this is my idea. Who wants to back it? Believe in it, buy it. And by the way, this is my idea. Who wants to work with me? And you've got to be positive to kind of pull people through. So I think that's the one thing that's really key.
So presumably now, like, every door opens because you've built this incredible brand. Everybody loves it. Everyone's with you on that journey and really inspired by it. When you were 18 years old and just starting out in this business world, what did you have to do to sort of get by and get through? And some of those things, I think, some of those lessons that you learn in the earlier stages can be the best lessons to use taking forward, can't they? They can teach you so much. What were those like for you?
I think you have to be quite dogged, actually. And I think those are the really hard yards when, you know, it is difficult. And, you know, whether that's getting an order, getting a product made, getting paid for that product. I remember sitting in someone's shop and saying, I'm not leaving until you write me a check because you owe me money. You know, you have to be really determined. And often I think I remember Lord Young, who's my sort of business hero, he used to sort of say, there's nothing more dangerous than a young business with too much money. It needs to be difficult because those are the lessons you need to learn. So, I mean, you know, trying to persuade manufacturers to make my products when my quantities were tiny, and yet I needed a really special product to stand out, then trying to get an order, trying to persuade a customer to buy my product when they had no track record and it's much easier to buy a big known brand, and then trying to persuade them to not pay me last, and trying to, you know, it's just you have to be, you know, you have to kind of learn to take the stomach punches. And to be honest, I still have that. I mean, you know, it's still absolutely that now. You know, every day can be a stomach punch, and that has to be your state of normal a bit. So you have to get a bit sort of thick-skinned about it. But I think you learn that in the early days, and I think every time you get a win, you build on those wins, and you kind of think, you know what, I did it last time, I can do it again. And I think that sort of stays with you, and you build your confidence.
It's interesting. I remember we did an interview with James Dyson, and he was telling us that sort of 2,900 iterations of a product down the road, and finally he sort of had the breakthrough and got where he needed to go. Similarly, we did an interview with Rich Joseph of Joseph Joseph, who said the same thing. You know, this lady in John Lewis, who happened to be a buyer that believed in what they were doing with a chopping board, then transformed the nature of what he was doing. Has there been a moment like that for you where you've said, right, this is now a turning point, we're up and running and we are heading in the right direction?
Oh, I mean, there's so many turning points. I mean, from, you know, finding a manufacturer in the England who could just get going and deal with my small, tiny quantities, to then suddenly finding one in Italy that actually could do everything fully factored, and I wasn't ordering the zips and the leather and everything myself. I remember ringing my mother from a phone box in Golden Square, getting my first big order from the States, my first export order. You know, opening your first shop and realizing that talking to it. There's been so many. I mean, I've been in, you know, this business for so long. So there's literally so many different points. But I think that the point is you have to live with failure. And it's hard because naturally you kind of want to skirt away from it because it you know, it's tough to take. Still now, every day, we've always got things that go wrong, or you had a crisis yesterday, something was stuck in customs that was key, and we've got some massive orders coming in, which is going to sell out, it's going to be so exciting. And the whole thing was, there was a strike in Malpensa Airport and everything got soaked and it's all, you know, and still growing mold. I mean, trust me, there's, you know, you're fighting every single day. But I think that you learn that you will get through it. And I think, Fanaf, I had a, and I talk about this in the book, my eldest son wasn't very well at one point. He's now well, but it was kind of a really frightening time. And the one thing that taught me, and one of the most brilliant silver linings that we all refer to a lot about that time, is it makes you realize that nothing matters that much and you will get through it somehow. You know, all of these problems, they are big dramas, but it will always be sort of resolved and you will look back and it will be fine. So you just have to, in the moment, know that you will find, you know, you will naturally navigate through it as best you can and make the best of the situation. You know, some things have better outcomes than others, but you will find a way. So you just have to kind of sit with that. But it's uncomfortable. Failure feels hard. None of us like failing. So it's quite easy to veer away from it, but you have to kind of lean into that a little bit, I think, probably, or at least learn to kind of realize it's part of the process. There's a lovely graph, actually, which is called the creative process, because with creative things, with all things, but with creative things, as you know, with your product, you're quite sort of on the line publicly. You know, it's my name and I'm saying I like this. And when you're designing, you know, you start off going, I love this idea, it's amazing. And then you sort of, a few weeks in, you're like, it's actually quite hard, or it's too expensive, or it's not working. And then actually, I don't like this idea. In fact, it's really bloody hard. And actually, I hate this idea. And then you're like, I actually hate myself. That's when you're at the bottom of the curve. And then you sort of work your way up, going, you know what, maybe there's a way. Actually, I think I can find a solution. And then it's sort of, okay. And then you look back a year later and go, actually, the product's completely great. But at the time, you just can't see it. So I think that curve, I now know when I'm at the bottom that I will work my way up again. But there were many years when I hadn't learnt that. So I think you do learn that you just have to kind of work through it and you will find a way.
Did you ever wobble? Ben and I had a bit of a wobble. Then we pulled ourselves back round, a bit like the creative process you've just described about putting our name above the product and actually having that as a thing. Did that ever make you feel uncomfortable? Did you ever wobble about that, or did you think, no, I absolutely need to stand by this? This is who I am.
Well, I mean, I started so young. I started my business at 18. So to be honest, I didn't really think about it then. Actually, I was, you know, just started a business and it sort of seemed like a brand name. And then, I mean, there are pros and cons, aren't there? You are sort of quite vulnerable, you know, and yeah, it is what it is, honestly. So I have decided there's no point thinking about it because it's too late. So I put my energy elsewhere. Be more sensible sometimes to have something that isn't so, A, you're not so personally invested in. Also, you know, if ever anyone, you know, decided to buy my company at some stage, which I don't want to sell, but, you know, it's your name. Do you know what I mean? That feels quite weird. And if it continues beyond me in any shape and form, it's sort of your name, which is, so that bit is a bit strange, but it's too late. So I'm not going to dwell on it really for that reason.
Forget it. Park it. Stupid question. I should never have asked. I was going to ask you about, this is a curiosity piece. When I was reading your book, you talked about how when you were growing up, obviously, when you were growing up, you weren't a great cook, but you were talking about how your mum was an amazing cook and how every meal that was served with Brussels sprouts came accompanied with this chive, which was shaped in a bow. Is that your bow? Is that where your bow comes from?
I think so much comes from my mother. She's incredibly creative. And she used to a bit of teaching, but she in my sort of later years, she wasn't working so much. And so in a way, she poured all of her creativity into home. And sometimes I feel very guilty about that because I don't have the sort of spare time and I've had to sort of make peace with that. I put my creativity in other areas and we sort of find our way. But she used to do these amazing treasure hunts for birthdays. So it sort of made the present much more exciting. So you'd get the first clue and then you'd run and it would be in the laundry cupboard and you get the next clue and on you went. And the present at the end was always in a very sort of generously wrapped bow. I've always found things tied up with ribbons to be kind of exciting, maybe for that reason, I'm not sure. And I like the idea, the bow in a way comes from the idea of a trademark. So, you know, if you get a silver knife, you have a little trademark and you have the maker's initials and the year that it was made. And there was a lovely old trademark I once saw that was this sort of rather inscribed bow. So I think a combination of all those things made it appealing.
Family is a big, huge, huge part of your life. Of course it is. You've got five children. You're raising them alongside this company that's going gangbusters. How do you deal with this work-life balance that we always come back to, the juggle? Like, how do you make sure you're getting it more right than wrong?
I mean, I think mostly I've dealt with it rather badly, truthfully. And I say that not for sort of pity, but I just think that so often women are sort of told they have to be perfect and this and that. And actually, it doesn't matter. You can do what you do as long as my big takeout is what matters to children is that they know they are utterly loved, that they would always come first in any sort of, you know, serious situation. And that the mood around the kitchen table is a happy one and a sort of progressive, positive one. I think that, you know, that frankly, if we end up getting a takeout rotisserie chicken and it's all a bit chaotic and who cares, you know, it's just bit crap, but it doesn't matter because the mood's good. That's what I think stays with children, I hope. I've clung to that thought anyway. Versus having it all perfect, but actually the mother highly strung and the parents not actually getting on very well and everyone feeling a bit on tenterhooks. So, you know, obviously there's many better versions of just having crap chicken takeout and a good mood. But that's my basis, that if you get those elements right. And I also think you need to show kids that, you know, relationships are real and stresses. I'm very openly vulnerable with my kids. So I will, you know, they help me solve a lot of problems. If I'm stressed about something, I'll tell them about it and why and how I'm trying to work through it. And I think if you're just very honest with them, they feel vested and they know what's going through your head, because so often they just see me looking at a screen and, you know, in my head, I'm actually going to a problem in Tokyo and a problem in Hong Kong and an issue in production and, you know, and all these staffing issues, all the things that we deal with all the time, but they're just seeing me look at a screen. So you actually just need to kind of go, by the way, this is what's going through my head. This is why I'm probably going to be a bit scratchy tonight, because I'm just really conflicted about this problem. So I actually share a lot of it with them. And then we muddle through. And I can't cook. I can't even boil an egg. I have five children, four of whom are, I should say five, but four of them are brilliant cooks. One of them actually worked at the River Cafe. I mean, just to give you a sense. So you know what? It kind of works out, doesn't it? Just, I mean, maybe out of complete necessity.
I love the fact that you sent a child to train with Ruthie Rogers so that you would definitely have good meals around the table one day.
Maybe she took pity. but no, they're all really interested in food, but I think out of literally, they're probably just hungry. So I don't know. I think, you know what? Mood. Keep that front of mind. And that's all that actually, that's the basis. That's all that really matters. The rest is just a nice to have, I think. And that's, anyway, that's my cop out starting point.
It's interesting that you talk about the honesty bit though, because and how honest you should be with them, and even from a really early age. And I know that you're a stepmom as well, and you've had to navigate some tricky and tough conversations with your children on that stuff. I just remember from when Ben and I decided to embark on a surrogacy journey, and we had Fox via a surrogate, and we were thinking, okay, how do we best talk to Bellatrix about this, who at the time was only sort of 4.5, and it felt a bit ridiculous describing any sort of a journey like that to her. But I remember thinking, if we don't say it as it is, we're going to get found out later in many different ways. It's so much better just to tell the truth. And I think that is probably the same of life. How do you have those sorts of tough conversations with children? You've obviously had to have a few over the years. How do you sort of embark upon that for people that sort of struggle to know how to do that?
I think, you know, just kindly. It sounds so trite, but I think, you know what, just obviously you've got to kind of, you know, wrap it up in a language that is appropriate for a 4-year-old or 11-year-old or whatever it might be. And I think sometimes it's also okay to say something and then go back the next day and say, you know, I said that, but actually I've thought about it overnight and actually I'm not quite sure. But, you know, I think you can just let it be okay to be vulnerable. I mean, I inherited my first three children. Their mother tragically died, and I met them 6 months after their mum died. And they were age 1, 3, and 4. So they really feel like my children. It's, I think kindness, honesty is the only solution, but I think honesty ultimately is the winner. And I think the thing I learned from having bereaved kids, and I spoke to quite a number of specialists in bereavement, is that actually don't shield them from anything. That was the real takeout I had from experts, you know, down to they want to know if someone dies, they want to know, could I have done something? That's a question that needs answering. And so they need to know right down to, was someone with them? You know, was the blood? But, you know, all that sort of really kind of tough stuff. But they actually can't grieve until they've made peace with the fact that everything that was possible was done, or, you know, it, so there's a lot to kind of work through, and you know, you need to read a lot and ask advice and sort of go on that journey. But honestly, at the root of it is just kindness. I think that really, kindness and honesty are the two things. I think if you do those two things, you don't go too far wrong.
Yeah, and happiness, like you said before, about sitting around a table and the mood being positive and being happy, and, you know, that can-do attitude, I think that counts for so much as well. And children pick up on that all the time, don't they? Yeah. They really do need that around them.
Really cross-patch. The children call me the fun tampon, so trust me, there's times when I'm really not good. famously unfun. And I can sulk in really very far.
You and analogies are absolutely marvellous.
You not pull that quote out. I don't want that quote pulled out anywhere. Otherwise, I really won't make you my friend anymore to say. Okay? I'm going to hold that against you if you pull that quote out. That's in the Daily Mail. I will kill you.
Oh, my my God, that's so good. That's so good. We won't talk about the bra conversation we had prior to coming on air. Either. We'll just leave that. So where does this leave James as well? Because how on earth can you work with your husband? I mean, genuinely, how do you cope working with your husband? Because I honestly think that would be the straight course to path to divorce for Ben and I. So how do you make that happen and make it happen successfully without problems?
Well, he's a saint, truthfully. He's quite annoying at times, but he's a saint. And and he doesn't really care. I think it's the bit I like about him, though, is he really doesn't sort of care about my sort of, you know, ups and downs. No, he's very happy in his own skin, actually, my husband, which is a really admirable thing. Because a lot of the time, he does a huge amount of the work, and a lot of the time people just talk about me. And actually, I think it's very cool that... I wish I was that cool that, you know, I wasn't sort of needy in that way. He's very comfortable with who he is. And he's actually quite a nice man. That sounds, you know, he rips the mickey out of me, so he's not properly nice, but he's, you know, he's kind in that way. So we work together mostly quite well, and we can argue a bit at times. I'm neurotically organized, as you probably know. He's got your inbox. I have to remind him seven times too. I always say this is the sixth time of asking, you know, now, because I know by the seventh I'll probably annoy you so much you do it. Case in point, the plumber finally today after the seventh time of asking. So we're quite opposite, but equally I'm the sort of person who's kind of going, let's worry about tomorrow. And he's like, it's Saturday, the sun's out, let's make some really nice coffee. Let's, like, you know, live in the moment. So we're real opposites, and I think you need opposites probably mostly. And so he's quite good for me, I would say. I'm not sure I'm that good for him. He's quite good for me.
You're very good for him. I'm sure you're really good for him. But it is interesting what you say about that, because I was going to ask you about whether it's lonely being a leader. But I guess you've got each other, actually. Even though your name is above the door, it's very much a team, isn't it, the two of you?
It is when he wants to talk about it. Of course, I'll talk about work all day and all night. And he literally goes, he always has his hand on the bedroom door. And I'm like, take your hand off the bedroom door, I want to talk to you about this. But it's like the exit, you know, it's like pulling the emergency cord. And luckily, two hour journeys to Wiltshire where I've got him trapped and I can go through all my worries. He never has any worries. It's really interesting. I have this whole thing I need to go off my chest. He never once says that he's got a worry. It's really interesting. We're so different. But yes, and I'm so lucky, you know, I have incredible parents. My dad started a business very young, and he in particular, my mother's very supportive, but not less well at the moment, actually, unfortunately. But my father is still on my board, aged 80-something, and is sharp as anything, and is just brilliant. And he is my very much a sort of a real sort of sounding block. And I call him my harshest critic, because if I ask advice from him, it will always be quite tough, but absolutely unvarnished advice, which is actually the most useful advice, honestly. So I do feel very supported in that way. And I feel supported by I've got a great group I work with some of whom I've worked with 20 years at work, and they're my dear friends, truthfully. But, you know, that I can, you know, that's a great sounding board of people who know what we're dealing with, know me, know, you know, the sort of the plan. So I think you have to build that around you, but I feel incredibly lucky in my family for sure.
And do you feel like you, now that you're where you are in work, in life, you actually, and I picked it up in your book, you sort of say, before I got to 50, I sort of felt like I didn't really want to say too much, but now you feel like actually you've got loads to say and you want to share it. Is that important to you, mentoring as well, and how you do that with the next generation of female leaders that are coming up?
I really think so, actually, and it's the one thing I do care really passionately about. I actually regularly kind of get together groups of women, and it's amazing what comes. It's a huge sort of kindness. People talk about women as being catty. They're not. They're so supportive, and I do really believe in that. If you can see it, you can be it. And I had an amazing aunt who was just my legend, Aunt Wiz, she was called, who never had kids, and she was just one of those amazing women who was just really inspiring. I have a group of friends who, female friends, you know, just are really impressive women who I just look up to and think, actually, you know, they can stand up there and do that. I can do it. You know, it really does help to have that sort of, that sort of group around you. I do think, that, you know, we need to really sort of sometimes push ourselves to slightly less comfortable positions. You know, I talk about our generation, my generation, as being the sort of transition generation from my mother, who worked a bit but didn't have a major career, to, you know, me having a busy career, and therefore, you know, trying to juggle the home and the career is quite challenging, because we have the sort of the memory of our mums doing the lovely ribbons and presents and, you know, Brussels sprouts with Thai chives, which is quite, you know, you feel guilty. So we have to sort of make peace with that, and actually, I think, pave the way for getting rid of equally the insecurity you have when you sit in a serious board meeting and you think, I'm sort of one of the few women here, why I don't belong here. But, you know, we need to push through that uncomfortable feeling to actually, therefore my daughter can see me doing it, then she can think I can do that too. So it's a rambling answer, but I was distracted by the thing that came through the door. Lost my thread.
It's another plumber. Oh yay, joy. No, but it does make it. It does. No, it does make perfect sense, because I talk to Bellatrix, my daughter, about this sort of stuff now. I mean, we have this moment where I'm putting her to bed and Ben's away because he's always away, and he's always on the water somewhere in the world on a boat. And so because of that, Bellatrix and I have this sort of moment before she goes to sleep at night where it's a good stalling tactic from her, but it allows us to actually have a bit of a chin wag before she goes to sleep. I'm under no illusion of the fact that she's just using it as a stalling tactic to stay up, but I feel like I'm closer to her as a result of it. But we have this sort of conversation, and you know, she talks to me about what she wants to do when she's older and this, that and the other. And it is true to say that if you are a busy working mum, you do at least have that play where you can say, you can do what I do, you can do what daddy does, you can go and do whatever else you want to go and do. And she does look at it as an equal scenario, which, you know, when I was growing up, it was very much my dad that was leading the charge for that, and had this incredible work ethic that I absolutely clambered after and loved and aspired to. But then when I think about it, looking back, my mum did the same thing, but just for our home situation, a bit like you're describing your mother. So I don't know. It is peaks and troughs, isn't it? But it feels like the opportunity is there now for the taking for the next bunch of girls coming through.
I think also on the flip side, it's actually also an adjustment for the men, for the boys, because, yes, you know, I laugh. I always think it's funny. I assume still, even though I work just as hard as my husband, sometimes you could argue harder, I still assume that I should write the thank you letter if we go to dinner.
Me too.
And actually, to answer, if I didn't write the thank you letter, I would feel like I was being lazy, or I was in some way making him do something that wasn't appropriate. And yet why? We both go to the dinner, right? We both eat the food. And why should I write the thank you letter? And so there are some adjustments to make, in the same way that I think, you know, my father probably never changed a nappy. My husband absolutely did. So it's moving that right direction. So boys also need to see where I have my mother's, you know, work, you know, home ethic of standards. Mine have obviously had to adjust, because I just can't do it all. I would get sick if I had her standards of home and trying to do the career I do. So I think my daughter's seen that, and she hopefully won't be having to put chive bows on Brussels sprouts. But my son has also seen that my husband shares the load on lots of things as well. So yeah, actually we're doing, you know, it's not just teaching the girls to sort of say you can, it's also saying to the boys, actually it should be more 50-50. And I think it's much better by example, because those memories in your head are they're a sort of muscle memory, aren't they? They're very automatic. So I still struggle, ridiculous though it is, with the thank you letter. And I just wouldn't dream of asking my husband to do that. I don't know why, but I suspect my son probably absolutely would do that 50-50. So it's within a generation, it shifted a lot.
Yeah, that makes absolute sense. In terms of what you do to kind of, you know, stay on track, because you just talked about I'd sort of fall over if I had to do all of it. Are you exercising? Are you eating really well? Are you doing all those things that typically you should do to keep on the straight and narrow, or you know, or not?
I know the answer. I told you before we started this, I think I've done 300 steps in the last 2 weeks. I did 11 miles the weekend before that. So,
yeah, but how many miles have you done? You've done so many miles on a plane.
No, I did 11 miles the weekend before last. No, I'm not, truthfully. And I think it's really quite dangerous not looking after yourself. And so I think there was a point when I suddenly took over 3 children and I tried to be like my mother and I was working hard and I did nearly fall over. I got really kind of run down and stressed, and I had to kind of actually take myself away and sit down and think, how am I going to manage this? This is not sustainable. Yeah. And I had to put in the right help, and I had to actually assume that I had to sort of slightly change my you know, not standards, but my, you know, the reality of what I could manage at home. And I also had to change a bit at work, and I had to kind of rewrite my own. And I had to, sometimes it's quite good to kind of go away and big piece of paper and kind of go, this won't work, right? New strategy. So I did that. I think I also have learned about myself more in terms of what I can manage and what works for me. I love to walk. I love to go to the gym as well, but I'm just not anywhere near doing that at the moment, but at least getting out and doing 10,000 steps in the morning. And I have just not, I'm doing a lot of Asian work at the moment. So I'm just at the office at 8, and I'm not that person who can get up at 6 and do your exercise, then wash your hair, then look good and be ready for a meeting and get to the office. I just end up with strep throat. So you have to sort of know your limits. I also know that I can do that for a bit and I will fall over. I talk about in the book about, you know, putting stepping stones in, having a holiday, having a health farm trip, having a moment where you just have a time to regroup with yourself. Put those in. You have to be quite strategic about managing your energy and your exhaustion, because it's like sunburn. If you just go too far, you just step over and it can cost you weeks of being ill or unwell or, you know, whatever. So I know for me, the most fundamental thing is sleep. If I get sleep, I can kind of nudge away a flu virus. You know, that's my absolute 101. For me, food is important, and I have a terrible habit for wine gums, and I have to, that's my kind of crutch when it all goes wrong, and that doesn't help anyone. So it's planning. So I, you know, I plan, I take my work to lunch so that when you're hungry, it's there, not kind of rushing out last minute and then going for the wrong thing. So planning and organization, back to organization and labeling, is really fundamental. And I realize that's my absolute basis. And then obviously exercise is, I know it's the thing that makes me feel happy. Forget fitness, it's the thing that makes me feel good. And so at the moment, that's slightly, I do it at the weekends, and that's a bit frustrating, but that's, I think I can do that for 6 months and then I need to regroup again. So you just have to adjust, but I've had to take that very seriously. And I find that, you know, to the point of the fun tampon accusation, I know that my weekends have to be off because I'm on all week. And, you know, you're doing things and you're up and all that, but the weekends I actually have to become a bit of a, you know, a boring old moo and actually do a bit of me and chill and get a bit bored. Because if I don't do that, I will fall over the next week. So it's a bit military, but it's essential. I've really learned that as I got older.
I wasn't going to bring up the fun tampon again, but you did it all by yourself. You just walked straight back into that conversation. So I want to ask you finally then for a performance tip, a thing that you do every day. We've talked about the things that you don't do and the things you want to do more of. What do you do every single day that you kind of live by, that you swear by, that you know is going to get you through the day better? Just even if it's just a little ickle bit.
I have to say, don't I? You know, wash your hair. Because the book is called If in Doubt, Wash Your Hair. And I think that came about because it's that small little thing of self-care, of taking 5 minutes, having a shower just is like meditation for me anyway. And it's that thing where you just feel better. You feel like you've made that effort. And the days I do and the days I don't are quite different days. So it's a silly tip, but it's somehow it's slightly sort of cathartic. It's slightly about washing away your worries. But everyone has their thing that just makes them feel like they can sort of manage and cope. So that's my probably my most basic one.
You'll be able to do that now you've had the plumber in.
Too right. The water will be piping hot.
Oh, Anya, you've been a joy. Thank you so much.
I worry I might regret this one. I can see I'll do something in the next few years. It'll be the headline. Anyway, whatever, you know.
It is what it is. It is what it is. It's great fun. Thank you so much. Bye.